So does anybody here know what affirmative action actually is? You're not alone. Part of it is because affirmative action is this really interesting collection of policies. It's built up out of a set of executive orders and Supreme Court cases. There's not any one particular.
Hi, I'm Scott Hewler, and you're listening to The Race Course, a series from The Devil's Share, the podcast of Duke Magazine. We followed the first iteration of University 101, The Invention and Consequences of Race, a course offered as part of Duke's commitment to anti-racism and its pledge to include anti-racism not just in its hiring, admissions, and actions, but in its very curriculum. Professors recognize this as a challenge.
I don't know what people mean by anti-racist. I mean, I think I have an idea of what I think they mean, but I don't know how to do that, right? That's not what I do as an academic.
But they're academics, so they designed a class that ran directly at race, how it does not exist biologically, in what ways it does exist, and what happens as a result of the invention of this notion. As we followed along, we've heard the class struggle through its early technological issues, nonetheless reaching students with material that hit them with the hard facts of race. What it is, what it isn't, how racism works, and how it lives in everything from the Constitution to immigration policy.
It's surprisingly enough, the race is like a non-biological factor was just hit me, and they hit us with that week one, and it just has been blowing my mind since.
Critical race theory occupied a class, and as the semester neared its end, the class looked at deeper and wider applications of the concept of race and how it affects every aspect of our culture. Deandra Rose, director of the Paulus Center for Politics, delved into public policy based on American attitudes and beliefs about race.
So the issue of race, historically, was part of that reason why the federal government was so hands-off when it came to higher education policy, and education policy more broadly. So lawmakers intentionally crafted the policy so that it would be implemented or put to work by the state rather than the federal government. So states were charged with putting this policy to work. And so what did that mean? It meant that they actually could choose not to disrupt how their colleges or their universities allocated benefits on the ground.
Professor of Public Policy Jay Pearson carried on.
I'm a population health scientist, and one of the core tenets of health differences research in the U.S. context is that there exists a direct and a robust relationship between socioeconomic indicators and health, whereby one or some combination of education, occupation, and income are soon to be robust predictors of health outcomes.
Which, guess what those predictors are related to? No, go on, guess.
And it's persistent and profound differences in a broad range of quality of life, social well-being, and health indicators, whereby majority population white Americans hold a distinct advantage relative to many populations of color, virtually all Native Americans, virtually all Black Americans, and select Latino and Asian populations.
This led to what, if you're looking for it, is probably the best academic definition of privilege you'll ever hear.
So in the U.S. context, majority population, white Americans, ethnic white Americans, conceived of themselves as inherently superior to the degree that they could construct the major institutions and the rules and regulations that govern them, completely independent of virtually everyone else. It grants privilege, unearned advantages that are conferred as a function of this preferred category, direct access to the resources that the dominant narrative suggests matter, and that those reliably translate and to improve health. Same majority group has constructed mechanisms of oppression that relegate minoritized populations to inferior subaltern positions. An example of this is this construct of race. Discrimination institutionalized that racialized populations have to engage and negotiate to gain access to these resources.
That even helps explain how immigrants, who tend to arrive in the United States showing an advantage in health outcomes, lose that advantage over time.
You may arrive here not knowing who you are in our system, but if you stay here long enough, not only will we tell you, we will show you by the way that we treat you exactly where you fall out in this stratified hierarchy.
Public policy was just one focus topic as the class turned towards specifics. Associate Professor of Political Science Candace Watts-Smith discussed straightforward questions of psychology.
I want to know, why are people racist? More specifically, I want to know why do people say they want egalitarianism, but they don't seem to be doing the things that would produce that? Why? What explains that? I want to understand if we detect change over time. Are we moving forward? Are we moving backward? Do we even have the capability of understanding change? I want to know, how does any of this matter for politics?
One-time Duke professor of sociology Alan Parnell, now of the Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Communities, addressed how racism affects the most foundational aspects of our lives.
So what I'm going to talk about today is how racial inequality gets structured in the human landscape, how racial disparities, for example, and exposures to environmental risks and hazards develop, why there are racial disparities in access to all ranges of public infrastructure. Some specific questions: which neighborhoods have expressways built through them? Where are landfills located? Where are toxic chemicals stored? Where is mortgage insurance unavailable? What areas are excluded from basic services like water and sewer?
Which disadvantages, guess who?
Racial residential segregation refers to the spatial separation of racial groups. It's most persistent manifestation primarily disadvantages African Americans.
On purpose.
The ideology of white supremacy and separation, and it takes various forms like white flight, when white people fear people of color moving in and leave the neighborhood. And it is the intentional action of government, as I'm going to talk about. Federal policies, programs, state laws and regulations, and this local policies. So it's built into the American landscape at every decision by the federal government and by these governments. Federal policies, rules for mortgage insurance underwriting, especially back in the 30s and 40s. State policies where highways go, permits for landfills, things like that. Then local government, land use rules, policies, zoning, annexation, things like that.
Associate Professor of Sociology Tyson Brown, director of the Duke Center on Health and Society, talked about how race affected medicine and health.
With the recent attention to structural racism, long overdue, as well as the disproportionate impact that the pandemic is having in black communities. And it's becoming more and more clear that population health is a mirror reflecting societal arrangements. And along those lines, I'd like to share an overview of research on the links between structural racism and health today. And there's really this burgeoning body of research that suggests that structural racism is in fact toxic for population health. However, our understanding of these phenomena has been hindered by both conceptual and also methodological gaps in the research literature. And so my research aims to address these gaps by conceptualizing, quantifying, and mapping structural racism, as well as its impact on population health.
Here's a simple way to look at it.
You know, I'm really interested in studying health inequality because I'd like to shed light on the issue of the unnecessary human suffering, right? And this is particularly striking if we think about excess mortality or deaths that could have been avoided. And so there was a study by a former Surgeon General that showed that 229 excess deaths per day could be averted if the health of blacks matched that of whites. And this is equivalent to a 767 with all black passengers crashing and killing everyone on board every single day, right? So this is enormous. That's really huge implications.
Surgeon General Jerome Adams, who created the report, suggested ways the black community could bring its suffering down to the levels seen in the white population.
He had some advice for black and brown families he thought we might keep them safe and reduce some of the disparities of COVID deaths. Yeah, he used racially charged language and basically attributed it to higher rates of drinking and alcohol use, right? Particularly among older adults, particularly among older black and brown adults. The problem with that explanation and rationale and prescription, if you will, from the Surgeon General of the United States is that black and brown people use drugs and alcohol, illicit drugs and alcohol, at equivalent or lower rates than white people. Right? And so that's not a driver. But I also think it's useful to highlight the fact that health disparities, you know, really have substantial economic costs as well. So if it doesn't really resonate with folks on the humanitarian grounds, then we can take it on sort of the economic front, right? And so there's an influential study that showed that black-white health disparities cost more than $200 billion. That's with a B, annually. And this is in both direct and indirect costs, right?
And remember, race isn't a thing experienced only by people who identify as black. To consider race in popular culture, professor of history and theater studies Esther Kim Lee talked about various pop culture stereotypes Asian Americans face.
And I think this is really the stereotype from which all the other ones kind of fall, you know, through. It's a perpetual foreigner. So this is a stereotype in which, where are you from? Chicago, where are you really from, right? Those questions that mark you as foreigner, and Asian Americans who've been here 5 generations will be complimented on how good their English is.
And that even a stereotype that the person expressing it might think is positive is rarely positive.
Now, the model minority stereotype, that's more recent. That came out of kind of the post-World War II era in the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement, in which Asians were kind of labeled as model minorities to pit them against black and brown people who are protesting and kind of making noise, making trouble. So Asians are labeled as minorities who are immigrants, are quiet, they do what they're supposed to do, they're not on the streets and protesting. But this also is an extension of the perpetual foreigner stereotype, because it's all, again, it's saying, you know, Asian Americans are different than so-called other, like the kind of ideal American. Exotic outsider is, again, an extension of the perpetual foreigner, but it's in which you're marked as almost like a otherworldly being.
Topic after topic, for 14 three-hour meetings, the flower of Duke's faculty looking at race gave overviews of their topics and discussed them with the students. And then...
There are no other questions?
The last content class was over. Of course, there was one final week. The 4 convening professors stood in front of the class and summed up, then conversed. And between professors and students, their last half hour together in this first ever university-wide course on race became something of a love-in. They'd been on a journey together. Clearly, they'd loved it. Professor Kerry Haney started off.
And I just want to begin quickly and end where I started way back the first day of class, and to say that what this was intended to do was to introduce you to this thing called race, something that scientists believe not to exist in any biological sense, but nevertheless has significant consequences for how we live and interact on a daily basis. And I also suggest to you that this would be an evidence-based undertaking in this class. And I hope this is a topic that is studied scientifically, and it's an academic topic worthy of some intellectual discovery and thinking and more research. The other goal of the class when we started was to introduce you to race from a variety of perspectives, disciplinary perspectives. Let me see, we've had sociologists, religion professors, economists, lawyers, public health scholars, public policy scholars come through, cultural anthropologists, cultural studies, African American studies.
This evidently had the desired outcome.
I know you all mentioned this serving as sort of a gateway course into like lots of different departments and such. And I would say, like, as a freshman, I think this was a really helpful course as someone who's interested in the humanities and interested in topics on race, to kind of learn about lots of different departments, because I came to Duke just knowing I went to do AAAS and that was like my thing. But like after taking this class, I learned about departments like ICS and like cultural anthropology and even sociology as well. And so it helped me to kind of broaden not just what I want to study here at Duke, but also like how race and those topics can be involved in different areas of study.
Professor Don Taylor reminded the students that as people now genuinely informed about race and racism, they still were part of a significant minority.
So now the good news and the bad news is that you all know more than most people in the United States do about the difference, for example. I think one thing I would like to encourage you all to do is not to wait like I did until I was really in my 40s to interrogate some of the history or ask about the history that I had been taught, and most importantly, the history that I had not been taught in my life growing up. And so, of course, you know, not teaching the history is not an accident. And my main point is that it's not that we were taught faulty history growing up. It's like it was never mentioned at all. So the history was erased. And so that's a lie, right? So I hope you guys will have a sense of discovery about race. I would never think that I could tell you what you should think about what happened in Wilmington in 1898, or I wouldn't tell you what to think about the fact that I wasn't taught about it and I could be a professor in the 40s before I ever heard about this signal event in American history that happened right under where I grew up. Like, I want you to figure out what that means.
Professor Amy Kwan reminded the students that the course represented a good direction for Duke, but that if it was a new university priority, it was not new for the faculty.
This class and the broader anti-racism or racism initiative broadly defined is, you know, sort of shockingly new, right? Even though we've always had experts on campus doing their thing, fighting the good fight for decades and decades. But in terms of bringing the entire university front and center, a Unit 101 course, and, you know, and all of a lot of you guys got the publicity and all of that, you know, it actually matters. It's not just about, you know, commercializing this or branding it. It actually matters that we have the Office of the Provost behind this, we have the Duke Endowment behind this, and we have the Office of Undergraduate Education behind this. Another thing I learned from this experience is that, you know, we're just individuals, but together we can make a huge impact. I want to applaud you, first of all, for being so engaged and coming. This is not an easy class. I actually teach a lot of trauma topics in my line of work because I work on colonialism and imperialism. And it's not that I was running to trauma, you know, because I have this perverse fascination with it, but it's because it's not avoidable. And so the topic is not easy. And I know that a lot of you guys have really been so engaged and, you know, front and center facing this every single day.
Kwan reminded the students that the class was a work in progress and encouraged feedback to make the next year's class better. Above all, Kwan said,
I don't want you to walk away feeling the weight of the, on your shoulder of all of the huge issues that are obviously still problems. But I just want to say that I want you to be encouraged. And in whatever little, small, local communities, in your friend groups, in your families, you can actually make a huge difference by, first of all, staying calm and, you know, being open to communicating in a way that will invite people to have these kinds of conversations. And so I would encourage you, whatever you end up doing, you know, just continue this fight because it is so important. And what I'm heartened by is that I think 2020, we could actually see transformations on the scale of what we saw in the 1960s. So you talk about historical figures of that revolutionary moment. I think 2020 is that moment for you. For us, we're actually ready to give you guys the mantle. So
the students said they felt prepared to take that mantle.
And it's been really interesting because, like, when I bring up the matter of race to my friends here at Duke, it's almost like I feel like I'm comfortable doing that because of, like, what I'm learning in this class, or it's on my mind because of the class more. When I do that, I almost feel like a sigh of relief from those friends because they're like, they usually respond with something like, oh my God, I've been thinking about that too, but like no one ever talks about that here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of like a powerful tool that all the students in this lecture, in this class, now kind of have the tools or maybe the courage to like speak about more of these issues.
As part of a commitment to anti-racism, the Duke administration dropped a challenge into the lap of its faculty. Do anti-racism. Whatever it means to you, do it. As academics, as researchers, and as teachers. Do it. Give it to your students, and let's see what happens. What happened is 100 or so students from this first course, and more as subsequent courses are taught, go out talking with their friends and their families. They walk into complex conversations bearing history, understanding, and facts. They know what critical race theory is and isn't, what privilege looks like, that race may not be biological, but as a concept, it has very real consequences. 100 students took this course and are carrying that learning with them. The next version of the course, with shorter twice-weekly classes and discussion built in, has already been successful. When first charged with doing anti-racism, Kerry Haney worried.
I don't know what people mean by anti-racist. I mean, I think I have an idea of what I think they mean, but I don't know how to do that.
What Professors Haney, Royal, Kwan, and Taylor did, with a parade of Duke professors and a willing cohort of students, I think that's how you do it. This has been The Race Course, a series from The Devil's Share, the podcast of Duke Magazine. Have thoughts? Email us at devilsshare@duke.edu or leave a message on my voicemail at 919-684-2863. And if you like, we'll share your response. I'm Scott Hewler, senior writer at Duke Magazine and producer of The Devil's Share. Thanks for listening.